I'm Leanne Ward.
And I'm Susie Burrell.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, we're chatting about the trending media topic of flexible dieting, or you may have heard it called if it fits your macros. Our client case study of the week is about being constantly hungry while trying to lose weight. And on our most popular segment, the supermarket product of the week, we discuss a new powdered peanut butter. And finally, one of our listener questions has sent us in a question about probiotics. Should we be taking them for general health? We'll give you all of the research and science behind that. But before we jump into today's podcast, Susie, you are always cooking up a storm in the kitchen. What have you made for the twins this week?
I do cook quite a lot. Sometimes I'm testing different recipes. Sometimes I'm cooking to thank people for things or, of course, to get that elusive, perfect Instagram shot. The issue, of course, is that contrary to what you see on social media, they don't always work out. And I actually do have to throw out a fair whack. So for every great photo, there's probably two or three dodgy ones that haven't quite made it. But I tell you what I have been perfecting, and I am pretty proud of this. I have wanted to be able to make a muffin with a crunchy top, like at a cafe for some time. Mm-hmm. Because whenever I make muffins, and they're not my favorite go-to, and not even my kids, but they do really well on social media. But I thought if I could perfect a crunchy top muffin, I would be pretty happy. And I finally have got the right mix. And it's not complicated. It's more like how you do a crumble, where you do a little bit of brown sugar with a little bit of wholemeal flour and do it that way. But I'm pretty proud of my effort. So I've been doing the crunchy top muffins. They're coming up particularly well. This morning I did like a breakfast bircher, but I did it as a muffin. Now, I think people will love it because it's like a creamy oats breakfast muffin that you could have in a bowl, almost like a cake, but it's not my flavor profile. I don't eat that. So the other thing is a lot of the stuff I actually don't really like that much. So that helps. And we try and give the rest to neighbors and things. But as I said, I also have terrible stuff up. So a couple of weeks ago, I had to get a picture of a banana bread. And I took it out too early, Lan, so it was still wet in the middle. I knew it was.
Oh, no. Did it
and
sink?
I got the photo. It's a great photo, but I also know the batter wasn't completely cooked through because it was really dense and thick because I tend to thicken them up with quite a lot of yogurt. And I ended up taking it to my mum's and it was literally, we just chucked it out. So that's the thing about Instagram, isn't it? Just because it looks perfect doesn't always mean that it is. And for every great looking baked recipe, there's probably a couple that are looking pretty dodgy. So I definitely spend a lot of time in supermarkets picking up wholemeal self-raising flour, yogurt and butter, which are the things that I tend to run out of. Because I will also say, I know we've got to get started, but I always give people the option in baking of using a sugar replacement like a monk fruit or sugar. But if I'm honest, I don't buy monk fruit sweetener because I think it's really expensive, like $8 a small bag. And I really try and make things affordable. So I give people the option, but I myself just cook with a little bit of sugar because I don't want to spend $8 plus on making a muffin or a banana bread recipe. So I like to give people that option because otherwise it can be really quite expensive, all of that healthy baking.
It can, absolutely, yeah. And you know me, I don't tend to bake too much. So I always love seeing your creations on social media.
Won't be long though. We're going to be having those purees coming up soon.
Yeah, no, I've got to get me one of those thermomixes or something like that, I think, so I can make up some baby food.
That makes it really easy, 100%. You can just freeze it all up and off you go. So you're never as motivated, I think, when the kids are about 6 months. By the time you get to 12 and 18 months and you're fully back at work, you just don't care anymore. But go with it at 6 months. I agree. Invest in the thermomix.
Awesome. Well, Susie, this week in the media, we're chatting about flexible dieting. So it's IIFYM, or if it fits your macros. What have you heard about this? I know it's big within sort of the bodybuilder and fitness community. A lot of the online coaches who, you know, work with clients for fat loss are talking about flexible dieting. Essentially, it's just a way of, I think, counting or tracking your macros and making them fit rather than, I guess, calorie counting. It's more tracking the number of macronutrients you're having. And for me, you know, I've sort of dabbled with it a bit in the past. If I'm going through a fat loss block myself, I will, of course, track, but I'll track calories and macros because we know that if the goal is fat loss, you absolutely have to be in a calorie deficit. And I think macronutrients, particularly from a body composition perspective, matter. You know, you don't want too many carbohydrates. You need enough fat, particularly for things like, you know, cellular health and hair, skin and nails and that sort of thing. And even just women's reproductive organs, how they work. We need some fat in our diet at a minimum of 20%. And I think protein, of course, is especially important when we're trying to aim to, you know, gain some lean muscle mass or maintain our muscle mass. So I think macronutrients are absolutely important. But how do you feel about just the concept of flexible dieting?
When it comes to me, I think this is what I would call a convenient diet theory for you. So it's really using a proposed model of eating to suggest that you can very easily eat high calorie or what we call sugary processed foods and still achieve your dietary goals. So if I'm putting it into context, and I wasn't overly clear about it either, because I think it just to me doesn't fit at all. How flexible, but then dieting, I'm just not really quite clear. But the best way I can think to describe it is that if you have a goal of fat loss and you're sticking to a certain calorie load or macronutrient load, so say you wanted to reduce your carbohydrate down to 40% of intake. So if you wanted to still have a chocolate bar at lunchtime, the way you would be able to do that is if you made sure you were getting your salad and vegetables that didn't affect your macros, and then a piece of lean protein, and then potentially you could get a little bit of, well, I guess you get the carbohydrate from the Mars bar and a little bit of fat from that. So you were keeping all the other components of that meal low in fat and light, so it would allow you to have a Mars bar as part of your diet. Now, I think philosophically it sounds really nice, because it means you take away from that idea that there's good and bad foods in that model. It's about choosing the foods you want to eat but still achieving your dietary goals. But I am yet to see it really work in practice, and my understanding is that where it comes up most of all is people who are perhaps doing physique changing or specifically bodybuilding, where they have a much wider range of calories and macros that they can fill. And so it doesn't matter if they eat a packet of lollies because their carbohydrate intake or requirements are very high. Whereas I really struggle to see how it could fit for my clients who are small people who don't have a lot of calories to play with. And I can tell you straight away that if they were doing flexible dieting and still including a high fat, high sugar food most days, they wouldn't achieve their dietary goals because they just don't have that much room to move calorie wise. So for me, it fits to a much larger frame person who has a lot more energy and calories to burn as opposed to the clients that I work with.
And I think that's a really important point, because a lot of the bodybuilders and the fitness coaches out there who promote this, and I think the funniest thing is that people, the first thing, and I Googled, you know, if it fits your macros, and the first website that popped up was the IIFYM website, and the first thing it said in big bold letters was, "This is not a diet." I thought, well, if you're weighing and tracking your food every day, that's a diet. So I think it is a type of diet, but I think people get away with it saying, you know, you can eat Mars bars, you can eat donuts, you can eat whatever you want as long as it fits into your macronutrients. But I think you make an important point that a lot of the proponents of this diet and a lot of people who are promoting it have super high requirements. So if you're a bodybuilder, you're doing 20, 25,000 steps a day, you're doing 7 workouts a week, you're in 3,000 plus calories, yeah, you're going to have a lot more calories to play with than the average person who sits at a desk job, might get 3 or 4 workouts in a week, but their deficit in terms of fat loss is more around that 1,500-1,600 calorie mark. You just don't have the luxury or flexibility of having a lot of these higher calorie processed foods. So I do think you're right. It matches a certain clientele more than it's something that fits everybody. But also I think for a lot of people, it's kind of just an excuse to eat processed foods. And as you said, you know, trying to eat 3,000 plus calories, specifically focusing in whole foods, is actually really hard to do. Like, there is people who, you know, they will eat a bag of lollies just to get their carbs and their sugars in. They will just add, you know, a Mars bar on top of their porridge in the morning just to get their carbohydrates right up there after a training session. They're taking down bulk protein powders because their protein requirements are like 180 grams a day. And good luck to you trying to eat that in, you know, whole foods. There's a lot of protein. So I think for a lot of people, yeah, you kind of do end up adding a lot more processed foods in. And then clients that I've worked in the past who come into my coaching service, Susie, obviously this isn't something that I recommend, but they've tried this before and they say, I don't want to do it again because I, you know, the tracking and the weighing and that sort of thing just drives me insane. And I get to the end of the night and I've got like, say, only 200 calories left. I'm starving. I've got no carbohydrates left because I ate it all at lunchtime. And what am I supposed to do with, like, you know, I've got to eat 60 grams of protein or something, and I've got no fat left and no carbs left. So I think unless you're really planning out your day and you kind of know what you're going to have for dinner, you can get very stuck in terms of using all of those, you know, with the flexible dieting. It's like, I want to go have a burger and some fries for lunch. Okay, that's cool. It might fit your macros now. But by the time you get to dinner, you've got no fat left. You've got barely any carbohydrates left. And you've got to eat a hell of a lot of protein. protein for dinner on very, very low calories. So what are you going to have? A piece of steamed fish and two green beans? I think it's just, it's not as flexible, I think, as what people really think it is. And the other thing is that most people don't consider a fiber a macronutrient target. So I think a lot of people aren't actually tracking their fiber intake either, which we know for general health and particularly gut health is so incredibly important. So I think that a lot of people are going, yeah, I'll have a burger and fries for lunch and I'll just have some steamed fish for dinner and a piece of broccoli, but they're not getting anywhere near the required amounts of fiber or that diversity of fruits and veg every day as well. And you know, they're eating a bag of lollies, whereas you could have a nice fruit salad and you're going to get a lot more nutrients in from the fruit salad, but probably a similar amount of carbs and sugar in there. So I do think there are some negatives to it. It definitely does fit a particular type of clientele. As you said, larger bodied, higher requirements, super, super active. And also those online calculators and the people that tend to set your macronutrient targets, it's not really something that's really based on, I guess, research and science, and probably should be adjusted quite regularly as people's weight comes down or their training sort of differs as well. But a lot of people will set their macros at the beginning and say, you know, I want to lose 10, 15 kilos, and that never changes the entire way through. Then they hit a plateau and they wonder why.
I really don't like my clients tracking their macros. Now, indeed, when I develop a meal plan, I've calculated the macros. But what I find, and I had a client just on the weekend doing this, so she started to count herself. So she was trying to understand what I was doing so she could adjust based on things she wanted to eat. And I think straight away this lends itself to psychological management of food intake as opposed to responding to natural hunger and fullness signals, because you're mentally calculating and eating along that line as opposed to what your body's telling you. And the other issue I have with it is that there's gross inaccuracies in macronutrient and calorie composition tables. So even though it might look like it is perfect and it's 5 grams of carbohydrate here, as you and I both know, there's a lot of inconsistencies in the databases. It's not always completely accurate. So when people start to count their macros to within a gram of recommendations, it's not a healthy way of doing it. It's really, in a way, promoting disordered eating, because you're saying, I had an extra gram of carbohydrate here, you know, I need to deduct 2 from there. And then you might be deducting it on a vegetable, which probably doesn't really even count anyway. So you're starting to isolate nutrition down into individual foods and macros when that's not really how we eat. We eat a diet of food, and the overall balance comes from the meal patterns and the meal balance. So I think it's trying to break down a behavioral pattern of eating into numbers. And for me, it just doesn't work. And I find it makes people really confused. They don't necessarily understand the science in the degree of being able to balance well. And most importantly, they're not listening to their bodies anymore. So I am really not a fan of macronutrient counting, even though I do it for my clients myself. And the way I would describe it is, when you go to the accountant, I don't want the accountant to tell me how to calculate my BAS. I want him to do it. So when I see a dietitian, I want the dietitian to get the balance right for me, as opposed to start to do it yourself, because you never do it as well as the accountant or the dietitian, because you're not factoring in all those other variables. So the only people, and I have seen it, I guess you're describing with bodybuilders, they might add lollies and things. The only time I've ever had to do that is with very young NRL players early in their career, where they might be a winger who weighs 80 kilos and they are 6'2" and they're doing 2 or 3 training sessions a day. And those people I might send to McDonald's, you know, that you would never publicly state, because that's how many calories they're burning. But for most people, I just don't really understand where it fits. And if anything, I think it can do more damage, because you start to, you know, lend itself to indulging yourself on these foods that really aren't healthy for us, and give yourself permission to be eating them psychologically without even listening to your body in terms of what it really, really wants. So it's not something I use. I think it's great to be aware of it. But if someone was asking me about it, I generally think it's an excuse to eat more rubbish. And, you know, we all follow a diet, Leanne. All of us eat a diet, whether we like to admit it or not. But for me, a diet is about sustainability, and it's about developing habits and patterns of eating that you like, as opposed to thinking about it in your head and thinking what you should be eating in numbers terms. And that's where we sometimes fall wrong with principles like this, which are asking us to calculate things. And we don't eat according to a science, we eat according to a behavioural pattern.
100%. And I always say that, you know, we eat food, we don't eat numbers, we don't eat macros. And I think that that's the biggest downside of something like this. Does it work? Well, if you look at, you know, the photos and that sort of thing online, you would think, absolutely, look at these people, they look fabulous. But looking lean and fit and strong and that sort of thing isn't necessarily an indicator of health. As you mentioned, a lot of these super lean people aren't necessarily healthy. And a lot of them have, you know, super low iron levels. They've got, you know, chronic and autoimmune diseases. Just because somebody looks a certain way and follows a certain diet pattern doesn't necessarily mean that they're healthy. And so I think that's a really important thing to note is tracking your macros is all well and good. What about your micronutrients? I would say that your micronutrients matter as much, if not more, than your macronutrients. And are you tracking things like, are you getting in enough selenium? Are you getting in enough folate? No, probably not, because when you're putting everything into an app, you're just not getting that diversity of foods. And again, people fall into that rabbit hole where they're like, and this is a perfect example of my husband. When I met him, he ate the same thing for breakfast, lunch, he had a second lunch and then dinner every single day because he was doing flexible dieting. That's what he did. And it was one vegetable at each meal. It was like broccoli and then beans. We had greens twice a day. He had chicken, he had turkey, then I think he had either chicken or beef for dinner. And breakfast was like this high protein, nutrient sort of cereal with milk, and that was it. And that was his diet because he had perfectly calculated his macros on a daily basis based on what a fitness coach had told him. Then I came in and he started dating me. This is years ago, and I've just flipped him on its head. Because we shouldn't eat the same thing every day. And just because it can calculate it in an app doesn't necessarily mean that that's healthy. He'll probably kill me for saying this story on here.
Oh, he knew he was alive when he met you.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's true health, you know. So yeah, that's my...
the healthiest specimen ever now. He fell badly in love with someone who gave him all the dietary information he wanted for free.
Absolutely. It works both ways. He reads all of my, you know, contracts and that sort of thing because he's a good lawyer and I do all his nutrition. Works well.
Shout out to David. We love David.
But yeah, just because, well, that's the bottom line, I think, for me. Like, macronutrients, of course, are important, but don't forget about your micronutrients. They're so, so important. And when you're just tracking macros, your micronutrients go out the window. So you will probably end up deficient in quite a lot of things. If you notice that your hair's falling out, your period's becoming a lot more irregular, you're waking up exhausted despite hitting your macros every day, is that health? And are they true markers of health? Probably not. Probably a good thing to sort of reassess what you're actually doing.
And they're very rough. Those macronutrient counters, they're very, very rough. They're not overly accurate. So take it with a grain of salt and use it as a general guide, as opposed to thinking that this is an excuse to eat a Mars bar every day. It sounds too good to be true, as we always say. All right. Well, moving on, a case study that has presented for us recently is a little bit about hunger, but not, we've spoken before, Leanne, about getting in touch with your hunger to guide your food choices, and that is incredibly, incredibly important. But something that comes up a lot for some of my clients is constant hunger. And sometimes I will start someone on their plan and their feedback very quickly is that they can do it, but they're feeling really hungry. And that kind of incessant hunger where they can't stop thinking about food and they're obsessed and they're eating their dinner at 4:30. And this for me is a big, big concern, but it's very, very common. So we did think it was a really good opportunity to talk it through. Mm-hmm. Now, physiologically, if you're consuming a well-balanced meal that ticks the box on your macronutrients, mm-hmm. but is also and reasonable calorie load. So, you know, you have a lunch that's got some salad or soup and then a sandwich or wrap with a decent amount of protein or perhaps some leftover dinner that's got, again, a serve of lean meat and lots of veggies and a little bit of good quality carbohydrates from some sweet potato or some brown rice. That meal that might clock in between 300 to 500 calories for the average person should, in theory, keep you full for at least 3 to 4 hours. So as soon as I have developed a plan or clients are eating reasonably well-balanced meals, if they're feeling hungry within an hour or two after consuming that meal, I'm a bit worried because it's telling me that something's not quite right with the way they're processing their hunger or potentially their hormones. So indeed, with some hormonal conditions like insulin resistance, because insulin is not metabolizing carbohydrate overly effectively, you can have quite fluctuating glucose levels, which can really drive that incessant need for sweet food. Indeed, it can be behavioral. If you have programmed to eat every couple of hours, indeed, the brain will seek out that stimulation. If you are consuming inadequate amounts of carbohydrates, so if you're actively cutting your carbohydrates out. So for example, you might have had an omelette for breakfast with no other fuel, no toast, or you might have had a tuna salad for lunch with no carbohydrate added. Indeed, it's not uncommon to get those sugar cravings an hour or two. So incessant hunger is a sign that you do need to have a step back and say, why am I not getting the satisfaction and fullness? But in my experience, Leanne, the most common reason is that there's hormonal issues driving it, which is an indicator to me I may need to get those hormones under control, or that the meals they're making up or developing according to what they think is balanced or healthy does not have the right macronutrient mix or balance of food groups that is going to keep them full for that 3 to 4 hours.
And I think in my experience, I would say that the most common things when clients say, I'm hungry, most of the time it's in the first 1 to 2 weeks of when I start working with a client, because the portions in the meals that I'm giving them, they're just not used to. Like, we've just flipped things on their head. Like, I've pulled the carbohydrates to half of what they're having. I've doubled the amount of salads and veggies, and they've kind of got a bit lazy and they're like, okay, I'll hit the carbs, I'll hit the, you know, the fat and the fiber, but I didn't have enough, you know, salad, so I'll kind of like won't bother with that or something like that. So I think that hunger for most, I would say 80 to 90% of my clients will stabilize within about a week of working with me. So I think that's just that difference in, you know, the body, the hormones, even the mind as well, in terms of just doing something a little bit different. So I think that that constant hunger, if it's in the first week of you doing something new or working with a new program or a dietitian or something like that, give it a week. Suck it up and see how you go. And if it's still there in the second or third week, then it's definitely something you need to look at. And the second most common reason, I would say, then besides it just needs, you know, your body just, it doesn't like change necessarily and sometimes doesn't do that well with change. So just give it a good week and see what happens. And if you're still feeling hungry all of the time in week 2 or 3, that's where we'd need to sort of shake things up a bit. Are you eating enough fiber? Are you eating enough protein? Most of Australians should be having 30 grams plus of fiber a day. I personally think, Susie, that our fiber recommendations are too low. It's 25 grams for healthy women and 30 grams for healthy men. I quite often will easily have my clients on 30, 35, 40 grams of fiber a day. I personally think that our Australian recommendations are too low, just my own opinion, but I will absolutely drive up the fiber and the protein in their meal plans. And the other thing is, for a lot of us, is it true physical hunger? It's that difference between I'm just craving something because I know I'm, you know, following a meal plan and trying to be quote unquote good, or, you know, it's Wednesday and I haven't had any chocolate since Monday, whatever it is. But it's just that emotional drive to eat, what I call head hunger, versus that true physical hunger or that stomach hunger. So I think that's really a big thing to ask clients is, are you actually truly physically hungry? If I said to you, go and have an extra veggie soup or go and grab 3 or 4 carrots with some hummus or salsa, could you do that? And they're like, oh no, I really just feel like some crackers. And it's like, if you've got a drive or a need for an exact or certain type of food, it's more probably that head hunger or that emotional hunger versus that true physical hunger. Because if you were truly physically hungry, you would eat any vegetable on the planet. I would just drink, you know, gallons of water if I was truly physically hungry and that was the only thing that was available. So I think it's really important to sort of differentiate between, is this true physical hunger or stomach hunger? So I think they're probably the two most common reasons. And I think probably the third one is clients who are trying to do it themselves and they just put themselves in a far too big a deficit. I had a DM from a girl just yesterday who was like, I used an online calculator. I know you always say you need to be in a deficit to lose weight. Well, my deficit was, I think it's just like 1,100 calories or something like that. And I was like, oh, it's too big. And I said, why that deficit? And she said, oh, the blog I read said it should be a 500 cal deficit. And I just think for too many of us, we're just putting ourselves in too big a deficit. So of course we're going to feel hungry. If you're, you know, she was gaining weight beforehand, you know, she's probably on 2,000 plus calories, has now taken herself down to 1,100 calories, probably ramped up her exercise in the process as well, because she's trying to, you know, lose weight. It's just too big. It's too much for the body to cope with. Like, I really do think slow and steady wins the race. So I think not enough protein and fiber. Is this actually true hunger, or is this, you know, just more cravings and that constant need or want to eat because we're so used to it, because it's a habit for us? And are we in too big a deficit? They're probably the three biggest things I think about when clients are saying, I'm hungry.
And I think leading on from that, it's time of day, because people start out with this intention of cutting back. So they impose the restriction early in the day. So they might start with an egg or two and one slice of toast. So they think, right, I'm going to be good. I'm going to cut down on the carbohydrates. Then they skip morning tea, or they just have a cup of green tea because they're trying to be good. And then they get to lunch and they give themselves a plain tuna salad. Now, what happens in my experience with that is, because they have restricted at the time of day when they're often most physically active and need the most energy, that they get a rebound hunger all afternoon. And that is where you have that constant need to snack. And, you know, at 2 o'clock, you're hungry again. And then at 4 o'clock, it's like you can't get enough food in. So you really want to pile the day with more fuel, in particular that vegetable bulk at every meal, including breakfast and lunch, and make sure that those first two meals are balanced. And you will notice that your hunger is a lot more in control on those days, because my argument's always been your race of good nutrition's won in the morning, kind of like triathlon, the race is won on the bike. So if you front load and get breakfast really well balanced with some veggies as well to bulk it up, a well-balanced lunch that contains all of your nutrient groups, you will find you won't have that constant need to snack all afternoon. But you're right, because the other thing that people do in the afternoon is they grab the crackers or all carbohydrate without their balance of their macros and getting some protein, getting some veggies. And the more of that really quickly digested carbohydrate you consume, like the rice crackers and the hummus and those ready-to-eat, you know, snacks, it primes the brain to look for more of those really starches, those really processed carbohydrates, and that drives your overeating all afternoon. So it's about getting the balance through the day, helps to control your hunger in the afternoon. And when a client presents and says that they're starving at 5 o'clock, I know they haven't eaten enough in the day. So it's about what's happening earlier in those meals. And inevitably, when I look at food pictures or food diaries, my constant feedback is, where are the vegetables? Where's the salad? Because I might pile a whole salad with lunch or add lots of veggies to an omelette and my clients will have nothing. They'll have a slice of tomato. So it's that shift in getting that balance right through the day, and that helps predict that hunger management in the afternoon. And then in the evening, a lot of it, as you said, is habitual. It's because we're programmed to have a lot of sweet food. So it's working through that and really thinking, right, the truth is I'm not actually probably hungry. It's just wanting something in my mouth. So how can I have something in my mouth that's not going to be too many calories?
Absolutely. I think there are quite a few, I think, different concepts that we can really look for here. So I hope that those sort of talking points have given our listeners something to think about, because it's going to be different for everybody. Just because you're hungry doesn't necessarily mean you need to eat more. It doesn't necessarily mean that you haven't eaten enough. Maybe you've eaten enough, but it's the wrong type of food, or it's the wrong mix of foods, or you've had just a huge leg day at the gym, you know, and you actually need to eat more than other days. And again, this is why I hate, or not that I hate, I don't encourage clients to calorie count and macro count, because most of the time you're trying to eat the same thing every day, but you don't do the same thing every day. And I know, Susie, not right now because I'm pregnant, but when I do a big leg day in the past at the gym, I'm hungry that day, like hungry. Like I'll go breakfast, snack, snack, lunch, snack, snack, dinner, versus if I just go out and just do, say, my 10,000 steps for the day and that's all I do, I can normally hold off on my brekkie till, you know, around 10 o'clock because I'm just not genuinely hungry, then go to a later lunch and then maybe have one snack in the arvo and have dinner and I'm done for the day. Like my calorie load or intake for that day is just significantly lower than if I'm doing a big heavy leg day in the gym, because I'm just not burning as much and I'm just not as hungry. So all of these things, I think, come into play, but it's going to come down to an individual basis. And again, we're going to plug dietitians here, and that's why it's so important to be working with a qualified professional. Because yeah, sure, you can do it yourself, but you know, I could do my tax myself, but I'd probably be losing out on, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars, Susie, you know, in terms of what I could actually be claiming. I could attempt to fix my car myself. Am I going to fix it? Probably not. I could attempt to, you know, clean my teeth myself and not go to the dentist for years and years, but eventually I think my teeth are going to fall out. So I think the need to see a professional in what those professionals are qualified in is so, so important. And nutrition is just one of those scary areas where, because there's so much online or because everybody eats, everybody thinks they're an expert in nutrition. So absolutely is a good time for us to reiterate the importance of seeing a dietitian if you have specific goals around your nutrition.
And a meal should keep you full 3 to 4 hours. If you're eating every hour or two, it's way too often. Definitely. Absolutely. That's a guiding light.
Absolutely. Now, onto our most popular segment, our new and exciting supermarket product. So a listener has sent us this over our Instagram, Susie, which is at the Nutrition Couch Podcast. So give us a follow on Instagram if you don't already, and send us your product. Send us your questions in, bearing in mind that we can't give you personalized advice. So we have had quite a lot of DMs saying from people, hey, Susie and Leanne, this is my height, this is my weight, how many calories should I be eating? We can't give that personalized advice over Instagram, but we are more than happy to chat about listener questions and the different products that you send through to us as well. So please do send them through. We've got quite a list now, don't we, Susie? our listeners are really enjoying the podcast, which is amazing. But today we're chatting about a product somebody has sent in called PB2. So it's essentially powdered peanut butter. So on the front of it, the marketing says 90% less fat and 6 grams of protein. So, I mean, it looks pretty good. I think it is gluten-free and it's a vegan product as well. So for 2 tablespoons of this powdered peanut butter, it's 60 calories. It is 1.5 grams of fat, so significantly lower fat than if you had 2 tablespoons of actual peanut butter. It's got 90 milligrams of sodium in it, 5 grams of carbohydrates. So obviously, because peanut butter is more of a fat, we don't expect a huge amount of carbohydrate. 1 gram of fiber for the 2 tablespoons of powdered peanut butter, and 6 grams of protein. So 6 grams of proteins is a big whack in 2 tablespoons and quite low calories as well at just 60 calories. So I've actually got some sitting in my cupboard at the moment, Susie. A brand, I think, in the past has sent it to me, or I don't know, it's ended up somehow in my cupboard. I did mention to you, because Susie said, where do you actually buy this from? And I said, I've seen it in my gym, because my gym has this big fancy vending machine and they sell, you know, broccoli chips and protein cookies and all the health halos that we've talked about in the past. But this is actually something that I don't consider too bad. I actually am sort of a fan of it, Susie, because you can get the taste of the peanut butter in it for a lot lower calorie, a lot higher protein. So again, if you're in a deficit and you're trying to lose body fat, it's a good option. It's nothing like real peanut butter, I must admit. You kind of mix it with water and it forms like a little bit of a paste. So I've actually put it in porridge, in my porridge in the morning. So I've sort of put some of this in and the taste is there, but it's just nowhere near as concentrated in terms of the taste as normal peanut butter would. But I guess it is sort of what probably at least a third of the calories that 2 tablespoons of normal peanut butter would be. So I think it has a time and a place, and it's definitely something that I'm not going to completely discount at all, but for the right type of person, I think it could be quite helpful. What are your thoughts?
This is one of the most interesting products I've ever seen. And I just had a look, actually. It does say it's available at Woolworths. It sells for $10, which is obviously significantly more than a standard peanut butter. It's imported from the US. And I will disclose that I am an ambassador for Mavers, an Australian peanut butter. So I'll be very careful here. I think it's really interesting, because you're right, it gives people an opportunity to potentially enjoy the protein-rich benefits associated with peanut butter with a lot less fat. It does have added sugar and salt, which a number of the peanut butters on the market now, including the Mavers range, don't have. So there's a downside to that. And I think for people who potentially are counting their fat or really love the taste of it, it's an option, but you're going to pay for that. You know, it's $10 per jar, which isn't insignificant. And I just think, wow, I guess the other thing going through my mind, and we haven't discussed this before, like, do you think you'd lose some of the sort of antioxidant potential with some of those nuts in the way that it had been processed?
Yeah, I mean, I think the potential is definitely there. But again, probably peanut isn't like what I would call the healthiest type of nut or anything. Yeah, I mean, it's more of a legume, isn't it, than a nut. But yeah, there are pros and cons. Like, I think it sort of falls mid-range for me. Like, it's not something I highly recommend, or I don't think I've ever written it into a meal plan for a client, but I can see that it has a place, I guess. But you definitely do need to be using, I think I sort of originally added about a teaspoon to my porridge and I literally couldn't even taste it. So you do have to be using quite a lot of it, like sort of the 1 to 2 tablespoons that's recommended in the serving size, which again, the container's not actually that big. And for $10 a pop, the price does add up quite a lot. So
just off the top of my head, looking at it, I'm wondering actually if it would be a reasonably good ingredient for homemade bliss balls, or even to bump up the protein content of baking.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Because if I cook with peanut butter, I'm often using it as a fat, almost as an alternative to having extra virgin olive oil or butter.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the issues when it comes to protein balls in particular is if people don't have or want to use protein powder, what's an ingredient you can get in there? And I'm thinking if you were making a bliss ball, I would probably use it there. I wouldn't use it as an alternative to peanut butter, because I think that there's better 100% nut spreads out there that are better to spread and things.
Mm.
But if I had it at home, I would actually use it as a base to a bliss ball, as a way of getting the protein in there without using protein powder.
Yeah.
Of interest, because only 2 tablespoons is almost 6 grams of protein. So that's really strong.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, and for only 60 calories.
That's how I would absolutely use that product if it crossed my path. And then compared to the cost of protein powder, it's actually not too expensive, because of course protein powder is coming in at about $20 per container. So yeah, just off the top of my head brainstorming, that's how I would actually use it in real life if I was making protein balls. Of course, you can't send those to school because then they have a nut base.
Mm-hmm.
But for adults at home, or while the kids are all homeschooling, if you were making bliss balls, you know, you could do peanut butter banana balls with that really easily. It would probably, I think, work really well in products like that.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think smoothies as well. A lot of people, again, don't like to use protein powder, and for whatever reason, I think that's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, smoothies are generally, and again, especially if you're, following a vegan or a plant-based lifestyle, you can't get a good whack of Greek yogurt in there. You're actually going to be quite limited with your protein if you're A, plant-based, and B, don't like adding protein powder. So I think this is a really good option to get a little bit more protein into something like a smoothie as well. So I do think it definitely, I think the perks of it is the 6 grams of protein for only 60 calories. I think that's amazing, particularly for people following a plant-based lifestyle. Would love if the fiber is a little bit higher, but, you know, at least there's a gram in there. But I think overall it's a medium-sized product that we could recommend? I'd definitely recommend it. I wouldn't shy away and say it's not recommended, but I think it has a time and a place, and for the right type of person, I think it could actually be quite beneficial.
Absolutely. For plant-based diets, you're right. Breakfast smoothies, great choice. And I might have a play with it and some bliss balls actually. Mm. But that's exactly where I would use it. So if you've used it, we would love to hear from you, post your recipes or experience with it. But I think we'll continue to see more and more of these food products that are almost novel to complement the diets that we all have. But that's a US product. It wouldn't surprise me if we see an Australian one
very soon. I think there are a few Australian brands. Yeah, this is just the one that one of the ladies sent me over Instagram, so I screenshotted this exact brand, but I think there are a few different brands on the market. The one in the vending machine at my gym is definitely a different brand. I mean, I've seen a chocolate version of this as well, so it's powdered PB and chocolate together. So I think they're almost trying to, I don't know, make like some sort of like healthy Nutella or something like that for it. So I think, again, you know, there's a few different flavor combos there as well. So definitely, yeah, a few interesting and exciting products coming to the supermarket. But yeah, I don't mind this one overall. And I do think, as we mentioned, for someone following a plant-based lifestyle or trying to keep their fats or their calories overall quite low, it can definitely have a time and a place.
Very interesting one. Good find. Good find. All right. Well, for our final segment of the week, we had a great listener question come up about probiotics. And if we're honest, we do get quite a lot of questions around gut health and specifically around supplements you can take and probiotics. And the question was a general one about, should we be taking probiotics for general health? Now, nutritionally, when we have a look at the research, there's some specific dietary areas that are proven to have a beneficial effect of probiotics. And for anyone who's not familiar, probiotics are the good bacteria that exist naturally in our gut, and we get them in fermented foods. So you often see them as part of yogurts or even probiotic shots like Yakult, and we see them in more and more of our foods in general to support and promote gut health. So specifically, Leanne, the areas of nutritional science I'm aware of that have been shown to have proven effects of probiotics being added to the diet are more for digestive health issues, things like ulcerative colitis, diverticulitis. I know there's some evidence to help reduce colic in infants and babies.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other key areas that you're aware of from the research that are proven to have benefit from using probiotics?
The colic in the babies is a great one. The ulcerative colitis is, again, very strong research to support that. Has, you know, as much chance as remission as what some of the steroids do. Traveler's diarrhea is a big one if you're overseas and, you know, something like barley belly, the SB
type. In the good old days.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough to travel to somewhere like Bali these days, traveler's diarrhea, absolutely. Antibiotic associated diarrhea. So in the hospital system, there's a terrible type of antibiotic-related diarrhea called C. diff. So there's really, really strong research for a specific strain of probiotic to help with C. diff. And there's a little bit of emerging evidence around IBS and some constipation, and also a tiny bit of evidence I found around mastitis. But I think, you know, by the time you get mastitis, I think you're probably not wanting to really do too much rather than just get those antibiotics in as fast as you can to help you out. So yeah, there is definitely some specific health conditions, but with probiotics, it is absolutely around the strain. There needs to be research to support the strain, the amount, and the type as well that you're having. So I think that there's a few things to think about for probiotics, but for general health, if you wanted a black and white answer, my answer would be no. I don't think that probiotics are needed for general health in a capsule form. I think we can take probiotics in our foods, but what's more important, and we have research to support this, Susie, is that prebiotics for general health matter far more than what probiotics do. So our probiotics are good bacteria. Our prebiotics are the things that feed our good bacteria. So they create fuel for our gut health, and prebiotics can naturally help to strengthen our gut lining and our gut health as well. So there's not enough research for probiotics and general health, but where we should be putting our focus is on naturally occurring prebiotics. And for a lot of people with gut health issues and IBS, they're a lot of our high FODMAP foods. So I think just be really careful, but we don't absolutely want to cut out prebiotics in general, even though they might trigger us and cause a few symptoms. We still want to include as much as possible and as much diversity as possible in small amounts, even if it's sort of every second day as you can, because the research is really strong for general health and prebiotics, not so much probiotics, just for those specific health conditions we mentioned.
And when it comes to probiotics, I much prefer my clients are consuming them in whole natural foods as much as possible anyway. So plain Greek yogurt, that is not Greek style yogurt, which is different, but actually good quality Greek yogurt, which is the one that doesn't taste as sweet, or fermented vegetables, you know, and sauerkraut and miso and foods like that. So I think when you're ticking the box on those, what we'd call superfoods that have, you know, packed full of nutrition in general and great daily additions, I definitely don't routinely recommend people go and pay for extra probiotics for all of these reasons. Plus they're another expense, and I would rather my clients are spending on good quality fresh fruit and vegetables and increasing the load. As we know, the wider the range of those products, the better our range of gut microbiome is anyway. So it comes down always to me to a good quality yogurt and things like that, just to be ticking the box when you're with your daily food choices rather than popping another pill.
Absolutely. And I just think that it's really going to be sort of the 1-5% of your diet. Like if you're taking a probiotic hoping to improve your gut health and your diet is crap, you're not going to get anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Like the foundations of a good diet are going to make up 85-90% of what needs to be done. And supplementation on top of that, we always say as dietitians, maybe 1-5% benefit that you're going to get there. But the problem is we all want the miracle in the pill. We all want to pop something and hope that it helps rather than actually do the hard work and reduce our stress and focus on sleep and focus on eating more whole foods. So there's so much that goes into a holistic, healthy lifestyle. And I can promise you that probiotics would be maybe 5% of benefit for the majority of people, unless, of course, we're talking about those specific health conditions. And if you did have one of those specific health conditions, such as inflammatory bowel disease or antibiotic-associated diarrhea, absolutely crucial to touch base with either your GP, but probably more importantly, your dietitian, because they will know the exact strain and the exact type of probiotic. If you had a bit of barley belly and some traveler's diarrhea, you're not just going to go and grab a random probiotic at the chemist. You're going to want an exact strain and an exact amount of that to take and an exact time frame as well. So again, you're not wasting your money. You're getting the true benefits, which are proven in the research. So I think that there is, you know, some really great emerging science around probiotics, but I think for general health, majority of people probably not needed. Absolutely focus on probiotics from food first and also your prebiotics from naturally occurring foods as well.
100%.
Alrighty, Susie, that brings us to the end of Nutrition Couch for another week. I'm always sad when it comes to an end, but I do think we cover so much content. I mean, it's been nearly 40 minutes, so I think we've done pretty well this week.
We're trying to keep our times to 30, but we're failing dismally every week, so we're sorry.
Some of these things we could talk about for longer and longer and longer, but we do try to cap ourselves so that it is a nice, short, sharp podcast for you guys and we can cover a lot of topics. So if you haven't done so already, we appreciate it so much if you could go and subscribe to the podcast and leave us a positive rating in the Purple Apple Podcast app. Now, if you don't have an Apple phone, we all know somebody that does, let's be honest. Grab someone else's phone, give us a good rating in the Apple Podcast app. We'd appreciate it so much. That influences the chart ratings and the higher we rank on the charts. And thank you for your support. We've been at number one for pretty much since we launched about 14 weeks ago in terms of the nutrition podcast charts in Australia. So we can't thank you enough for that. But those charts are really influenced by your subscriptions and your ratings. So if you haven't done so already, please leave us a positive rating or review, because the higher up the charts we are, the more people that we can reach and actually help and get some great evidence-based nutrition messages and science out there to the general public versus, you know, some of these influencers who are promoting all sorts of terrible things, Susie. So we do appreciate your feedback and we thank you very much for that. Give us a follow on Instagram at the Nutrition Couch Podcast, and we will catch you guys same time, same place next Sunday morning.
Have a great week.